This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with the new Secretary of the Department of Health and Hospitals, Kathy Kleber. She's been with the department for a while, but now has the top job after the departure of Bruce Greenstein. We will talk with her about the state's largest agency and healthcare activities. Much going on in the health realm, and we will talk with Kathy Kleber about some of the aftermath of the legislative session, including the response to the gubernatorial vetoes. And the executive director of the ACLU of Texas, Terry Burke, is with us. She will discuss what happened in the Texas legislature as abortion became the primary issue in the Lone Star State. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, it's 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. J.C. Kane is producing, and our guest is Kathy Kleber. She is the Secretary of the Department of Health and Hospitals, has held that position for about 3 months after working at the department for 25 years. Good morning, Kathy Kleber.
Good morning.
I'm impressed you commute every day from Thibodaux.
I do.
That's a tough drive.
It is a difficult drive. I've been doing it for over 9 years, though, and you just get used to it.
9 years ago, I almost got killed on that road coming from Thibodaux to Baton Rouge. Have you had some experiences?
I have. I've had some accidents myself on
really?
That road, yes, including a head-on collision as well about 20 years ago.
Well, I'm glad you're okay.
Thank you.
How many employees in the Department of Health and Hospitals?
Right now, we're at a little under 6,000 for this fiscal year, down from over 12,000 6 years ago.
Well, we'll talk about the attrition, or more than attrition, elimination.
Right.
But I'm sure you know all 6,000 by their first names, you know, their spouses' names. All
no,
that
but I
stuff,
actually, right? Having worked for so long, I actually do know a lot of the employees in the department.
6,000 people.
Yes.
You're responsible for one of the largest agencies in the United States. Not many states have a health system as large as Louisiana's because of our tradition of charity hospitals, but that is changing.
That's correct. Also, our tradition about in terms of having institutional services, we have employed through the department a lot of individuals in our institutions, and a lot of the reduction in employees that has happened over the last several years has been either to the closure due to closure or privatization of those institutions.
Now, there was much gnashing of teeth during the legislative session and afterward about the governor's vetoes, in particular how they affect your department, including children with developmental disabilities and how they will be affected by the vetoes. What's going on?
Well, let me just back up a little bit in terms of developmental disability services and what we've been trying to do for the last 5 or 6 years in terms of improving those services. Historically, as I mentioned earlier, Louisiana has a large institutional population. So many of our services historically have been in those institutions that are high cost, don't provide services where people want to be with their home, in their homes, in their communities. We've, over the last many years, have worked to change that, transitioning people out of institutions, significantly increasing our waiver slots to the point that in 2000, for instance, we had over 78% of our funding that went to institutional services, and now we're at about 45% going to institution and 55% going to home and community-based services. So we've really shifted that. We want to continue to do that. In that process, we also are trying to use the resources that we devoted to home and community-based services in a different manner so that we reach more people. You've heard the numbers of the waiting list, 10,000 plus. So we're trying to change that dynamic so that those individuals who are on that waiting list, even though many of them right now get services.
You gave a very big number there. How many?
10,000. But it's a number that's misleading because almost 9,000 of those individuals already receive Medicaid services, and about 4,000 of those individuals either receive other waiver services or other state or federal support services.
Well, as far as the NOW waiver program, that's what we're talking about. Long list, and how do you address the concerns that are valid regarding this?
Right. And again, you know, one of the issues that came up was the veto of some additional NOW waiver slots. I want to point out that those vetoes occurred because at the same time, the department was also given a $20 million reduction in our funding, that state funding that we had to address. So it certainly doesn't make sense to add additional services at a time when I have to really streamline and cut services in other areas. In terms of the NOW waiting list, though, again, that waiting list is misleading. There are people receiving services. However, the waiting list is a first-come, first-served list, meaning that many individuals on that list may not need services today. They may have gotten on as soon as they were eligible mm-hmm. for the system, which in most cases is when they age out of early steps at age 3. So when they become, their name comes up on the list, they may not need services at that point. But because it's a first-come, first-served list, I can't get to the people that really may need services today. You may have a situation where a family member's, you know, somebody gets in an accident and their circumstances change, a caregiver dies. And while we have some emergency slots, we don't have enough to really reach those people that are in need. So what we're trying to do is figure out how do we look at that waiting list differently. Is there a way to do some front-end case management so that we really know what that waiting list looks like? Who really is in need of services? Who can wait? Who can, you know, we can maybe get them a communication device with some state funds, and they don't need the comprehensive waiver right now. So the comprehensive waiver costs an average of $53,000, which is down from what it used to cost of about $68,000 several years ago. However, it's still a very expensive comprehensive waiver, and not everybody needs those comprehensive type services. So we're trying to figure out who needs just minimal services that, you know, again, they might need a ramp for their home or some environmental adaptations, but, you know, who needs that and who needs the more comprehensive services.
297-5633, your number outside Baton Rouge. Please call 877-217-5757 toll free. You had a meeting this past Friday.
We had a meeting with stakeholders, parents, advocacy groups, other stakeholders. We had some legislators and legislator representatives there as well. We were so pleased with the meeting because we actually came out of the meeting all agreeing and in a consensus in terms of how we move forward. And what was clear from the family members and the stakeholders that were there that we really did need to do things differently with that list. For one thing, we need to combine our waivers. We have right now 4 different waivers for developmental disabilities.
And those 4 are?
We have a children's choice waiver for those that are under 18 that provides a more limited scope of services. The average cost for that waiver is about $11,000. We have a supports waiver, which provides employment services, vocational supports for individuals with disabilities. That average cost is somewhere around $18,000. And then we also have a residential opportunity waiver that allows people to transition from institutional services into the community. And then we have our NOW waiver.
So what would a cafeteria-style single waiver do?
Well, it would allow people to really just get again, as I mentioned earlier, the list has people with a multitude of different needs. So it would allow us to, rather than giving somebody that NOW waiver, that comprehensive waiver, it would allow us to say, you know, if a child is up next on the list, maybe they only need, like I said, the communication mm-hmm. device. They only need a few hours of personal care services. We could just have a menu of services that they could choose from that, again, based on need, not unlimited, but based on need, and we would have individual caps for those people based on their needs. And that would, again, allow us to just give, maybe a person only needs $2,000 worth of services rather than giving and having somebody take a comprehensive waiver when they really don't need it. Because many of them, people, when they come up on the list, you know, they'll take the waiver just because they're afraid of what's going to happen in the future.
Kathy Kleber, the Secretary of the Department of Health and Hospitals, she's a 25-year veteran of the department, and I guess you've worked under several secretaries, including Bobby Jindal.
Yes.
David
yes.
Hood.
Yes.
How many do you recall?
Well, I've been here since 1988. So
that was the first year of the Romer administration.
That's right, yes, Romer.
Yeah, who was the Secretary of Health in his first... I'm trying to think of who it was, and I ought to know that, but memory fails. But
Rose Forrest may have been the secretary.
I think you're right.
She was the secretary, I believe, when I first came on board.
Inkster Show at WRKF.org works if you have an inquiry via email. And Carrie asks about your previous assignment. You were Assistant Secretary of Behavioral Health, and you were involved in mental health and addictive issues. And Carrie wants to know how budget cuts have affected that part of the Department of Health.
Well, in terms of behavioral health, that's one of the areas where we have actually expanded our services. And we've been able to do that because part of what we did, actually when I first became Assistant Secretary for Behavioral Health, we combined the Office of Mental Health and Substance Abuse into one office. At the same time, we embarked on a very aggressive effort to pull all those services together and to figure out which ones that would be Medicaid eligible. So, for instance, our substance abuse services, we were previously paying all state dollars for. We now have a system mm-hmm. that allows us to get Medicaid match for those services. So we've actually added 30% more funding into behavioral health over the last several years because of that switch to a managed care system that allows us to better match our state dollars.
So you're saying you're okay as far as funding on that front?
We've got a lot of work to do in terms of the managed care system mm-hmm. to make it work and really get the types of services that we want,
right.
Similar to our developmental disability services. We have been high institutional in our psychiatric services. We have worked really hard in the new behavioral management system, the Louisiana Behavioral Health Partnership, to be able to better use those dollars for community-based services and more evidence-based practices. However, we still have a lot to do with providers to get them up to speed, to be able to provide some of those home and community-based and evidence-based practices. So we're not there yet, but in terms of our funding, we feel pretty good about where we are as long as we can maintain that level of funding
okay.
for that behavioral health partnership.
All right. Roberta asks about the state not taking the Medicaid expansion under Obamacare. How has that affected the Department of Health?
Well, as you probably have heard, and we've talked many times during the legislative session, feel that in actuality that would hurt us, especially in the long run, and would not allow us to have services for
people
with disabilities.
You're saying taking it would
taking it. Yes,
hurt
I'm sorry.
You.
Would take it as in the long run would hurt the department, and we would have additional dollars that we'd have to cut from other services to be able to fund additional Medicaid participants. And again, I know there's debate about whether it's a savings, and while there may be savings in the short term, in our more aggressive models, there's not even savings in the short term. And we feel pretty strongly that putting 41% of our population on Medicaid isn't going to be the solution to make us have a sustainable health system.
But in the short term, aren't the feds picking up 100%?
The feds will pick up 100% of some of their services, not all of the services. And the unknowns with the Medicaid expansion primarily have to do with, are we going to have to increase provider rates to ensure a proper network? And we believe that based on the current guidance, that's one of the things we would probably have to do.
Well, when we look at these former secretaries you worked with, Kathy, you have obviously Governor Jindal, who believes as you do, and then you have David Hood, who believes passionately the other way.
Correct.
So
yes.
You understand there's a division of opinion on this.
Clearly there is. And again, I think if we could all agree on the assumptions and that we all knew what the end result of all this was going to be, it'd be a lot easier decision. But we don't know that, and we certainly don't have a lot of faith. I mean, even based on our federal match rate reduction that got pulled out under us last year, clearly we're not confident that what the federal government says they're going to do in terms of providing services and paying for certain services is actually what's going to happen.
297-5633 is your number, and we'll return and spend some more time with the Secretary of the Department of Health and Hospitals, Kathy Kleber, who commutes every day from beautiful downtown Thibodaux to Baton Rouge and then goes back home. And she's here with us, and we'll talk more after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Kathy Kleber, Secretary of the Department of Health and Hospitals, is with us. Now, as far as the overall transformation to Obamacare, how is that changing the way things are done at the Department of Health?
Well, there, despite, you know, whether or not we expand services or not, there are still many things the department has to do to get ready. I mean, there are the exchanges that, although we're not running a state exchange, you know, people that will be calling the department will be asking for services. We'll have to have systems of increased call volume that we're going to have to handle as people start wondering, you know, what am I eligible for? Where do I go? We also believe we'll have some additional Medicaid recipients because of all the publicity for Obamacare, meaning that individuals will now maybe they think they might be eligible for an exchange or they or some services, they're going to call the department and find out they're actually eligible for Medicaid. So we have anticipated some of that increase in Medicaid services. There are also a lot of data systems and eligibility systems that have to be changed to be ready for October 1st and the exchanges and then also January 1st. So we've had to do a lot of internal work with our payment management system and our Medicaid eligibility system to be ready for the requirements of Obamacare.
What is your overall budget, Secretary Kleber?
It's right about $9 billion.
And that would account for over a third of the state's budget.
Yes.
And much of that, despite the state's aversion to taking part in Medicaid expansion, much of that has to do with Medicaid,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes, actually, almost, I guess, 80% of our budget, a little over $7 billion is Medicaid. And the, a lot of that is because we have 25% about of our population in Medicaid. And, you know, when we talked before about the Medicaid expansion debate, many states aren't even close to that amount. So when they expand Medicaid, they're going to only get to the levels that Louisiana is at right now. So they're not looking at expanding beyond a 25%,
right,
whereas
so
we've got a lot more people to shoulder a 41% load if we would consider expansion.
41%?
It was where we would be moving to if we expanded Medicaid.
Okay. 877-217-5757 for Kathy Kleber, and we will take some inquiries as we move along in our remaining time with her. Now, as far as the privatization of the hospital system, how's that working out?
Working really well. We've been very pleased with the private partners that were selected, what they are doing and have committed to do in the future to make sure that we no longer have a two-tiered system for individuals that are uninsured. I mean, now when you go to a hospital, you will get the same types of services with private vendors that can set up different cost structures that will allow them to serve those uninsured population in a way that provides a much better, higher quality, and also we're already seeing at Our Lady of Lake some the ability for them to get rid of some of the backlog of testing and services that were required, as well as some increase in quantity of services.
Thelma on Perkins Road. Thelma, you're on the air with Secretary Kleber.
Okay, the question I have is, what is the cost per person for institutional care if the waivers go away?
Institutional care ranges in our small intermediate care facilities, which are primarily our group homes and community homes. Average cost is right about $70,000 a person. For somebody with severe disabilities, average cost is right around $60,000 for the overall small intermediate care facilities. For our state facilities, our costs are now well over $500 a day. So it's close to $300,000 a year for individuals that are residing in our one remaining state facility. And our cost, as I mentioned, for the waiver, comprehensive waiver, is averaging $53,000.
Does that help you, Thelma?
That helped me very much. Thank you so very much.
All right. Thank you. 877-217-5757, wherever you may be, for Secretary Kathy Kleber. Now, you've seen a lot of changes in 25 years at the Department of Health, and you know, just noted the budget has shrunk from about half to about half of what it was just a few years ago, right?
The budget has been reduced.
The number of employees.
Oh, number of employees. Yes, the number of employees.
Sorry, employees, but the budget has.
Yes. Has continues to increase because we have continued to have increased numbers of people on Medicaid, as well as I mentioned before, the types of things that we're doing with our behavioral health partnership. We've increased funding in certain areas.
Well, I guess some folks would have a hard time understanding how the budget could increase when you say you've gone, what, from 12,000 to 6,000 employees? How can that happen?
Well, again, a lot of the reduction in the employees was through privatization or closure. Those, in particular, in the developmental disabilities arena, those individuals mm-hmm. moved from public care to private care, and there were savings in that. However, as part of those savings that were, for instance, in the institutional savings for developmental disabilities, at the same time, we've increased our waiver costs. So we've increased our home and community-based services. So it's really been a shift in resources as we've privatized and reduced our state employees to private employees. And again, our waiver services, we've increased 92% state funding in waiver services over the last 5 years. So significant increases. Our now waiver budget for this year is right around $410 million.
That's real money.
Yes.
So,
And I do want to point out to the caller's question, we have absolutely no intent to get rid of waivers. Waivers are where the department has pushed to move to home and community-based services. Our intent is to continue to provide more home and community-based services, not less.
All right. Now, the CNSI contract resulted in the departure of your predecessor. What's being done to pick up the slack, to find a new group to handle this? You have, obviously, the wheels keep churning. What's going on regarding the departure of CNSI and the installation of a new entity?
Well, and as you may know, the CNSI was in the process of building a new system, so we still had our current vendor taking care of the everyday payment and billing and authorization. That vendor will be extending their contract so that they can continue to provide those services, and we can make sure our focus has been making sure people continue to get paid, they continue to get services, and so that will continue. We did, of course, have to work with them on some of the changes that are required by the new Obamacare and the requirements that are required in those systems. At the same time, simultaneously, we're working with Medicaid, with CMS, to develop a new RFP. Now, that's going to be a long process. The federal government has even more requirements than we first did the RFP several years ago in terms of what they want to see in a Medicaid information and eligibility system. So we are starting from scratch starting from scratch, trying to use some of the things that CNSI built, but we're not sure at this point how that's going to mesh with what CMS, their new requirements
right,
are. So it's a whole new process that
so
we have had to start.
A new RFP. When will the selection be?
It's a long time out before we even get to the RFP. CMS now requires new advanced planning documents. They actually have a pre-advanced planning document and then an advanced planning document that we have to do prior to even getting to the point of the RFP. I anticipate it's going to be at least a year before we even get to the point of issuing a new RFP.
In the interim, Secretary Kleber, which you say there's a vendor involved,
right.
Which company?
Molina.
Okay.
Molina.
So, and they were a bidder against CNSI, weren't
they? Yes, they were.
So I would imagine they will be attempting to get the whole shebang.
Well, I don't really know who's going to be involved in the new process in terms of bidding. But
well, and it probably is a good thing that you're not
That's correct.
Because that's what got the last secretary out on the streets, but the noise that's swirled regarding the CNSI contract, is that a distraction at all?
Initially, of course, I think more than anything, the credibility of the department, there was concerns about the credibility of the department. We've worked really hard to build back up that credibility. Right now, it's not any noise. I mean, we feel like that we've gone out there, done the things that we needed to do to keep services in place, to keep assure vendors are going to be paid, and that we continue doing our mission every day that we have so many great employees in the department that work hard every day to get things done, and their focus hasn't changed at all.
That brings us to, an observation from Marissa, who talks about or writes about the morale of state employees. The state employees have kind of taken it on the chin over the last few years. How's the morale in your department, the biggest agency in the state?
Well, I think, you're correct. I mean, the morale, it's been difficult because due to, not having enough funding, of course, we've not been able to offer raises to employees. We've tried to do other things to build up that morale. The reductions in privatizations, of course, make people anxious and nervous. I think right now we're to the point where there's not any planned privatizations, and we're at a point right now where we feel like we're getting stable, and that we really can keep employees focused on what they're trying to do every day, and reward them as much as we can for the good jobs that they are doing every day.
When have employees last received a raise? It's been a few years, hasn't it?
5 years. So this will be the fifth year coming up.
Fifth year.
Yeah, fifth year.
Fifth year.
Yes.
And that, we hear about now, government should be run as a business. In the business world, there are companies that go 5 years without giving employees raises, but usually there's a cost to doing that. There's attrition, there's morale, there are all kinds of things. I would imagine there's some concern about that.
Well, sure. Anytime that, you're not able to do that on a regular basis, it is difficult. However, again, I think that we have so many employees that are really, a lot of the employees that come to work at the Department of Health and Hospitals really don't come to work there for the pay. They come to work because they believe in what we're doing. And, whether it's developmental disabilities or behavioral mm-hmm. health, they want to work in that field and they want to make difference in people's lives. And so, we try and focus as much as we can. We know that that's not clearly the only motive for people coming to work, and we certainly would love to be able to offer them other incentives. We have tried to, wherever possible, reorganize and give people some different empowering in their jobs and investment in what they're doing. Some of that helps, but again, sure, we'd love to be able to offer the financial incentives as well.
Question from William. This is actually from Ann, saying, what is the state plan to provide non-emergency medical care for those persons whose income will not allow them to be covered by the Affordable Care Act and who will not qualify for Medicaid in Louisiana?
Certainly. And again, one of the reasons we focus so much attention on these public-private partnerships is to do just that, to provide a safety net system for those individuals that don't have insurance. So again, they'll be able to receive the same quality of service that anybody else, whether they have insurance, private insurance, whether they have Medicaid, that they receive those same types of services.
And another question from William about the waiting list that you referred to. What happens to people who are on that waiting list? What kind of consultation do they get or guidance while they're on the list?
Well, the people that are on the list are people that have already qualified. They've come to the Office for Citizens with Developmental Disability. They've had an assessment. If their needs change, they can come back and request additional services for state-funded services if they're available. As I mentioned earlier, we do have some availability of some emergency waiver slots for real critical situations. Again, not enough of those. What he brings up is the biggest issue that we have and that stakeholders also brought up, is that we really don't do a lot of assessment of those people on those lists to figure out who really needs services now. And that's one thing that was loud and clear from the stakeholders. And we want to make sure they continue to engage in that dialogue to make sure that we can do a better evaluation and provide additional services to people that are on that list.
Now, you had your meeting last Friday with parents and stakeholders. Will you have other meetings similar to this?
Yes. At that meeting, we requested contact information. We have also opened it up for other people that may be interested. We will be developing work groups around the specific areas that the families and the stakeholders requested, and in particular, the development of one waiver. These solutions aren't going to happen overnight. They're going to involve a lot of work from the department, from the stakeholders, to really come up with, we'll have to get CMS approval, so we'll need their work and their ability their abilities to come in and help us design a system that CMS is going to approve and that everybody can agree is a fair system.
You're an enthusiastic person,
I am.
Yeah, no doubt about it. You got a tough job, but you look like you're enjoying the work.
I do. I enjoy the work most days.
What do you think about on that drive from Thibodaux every
well,
day?
Well, you know, I get up early and I exercise in the when mm-hmm. I come to Baton Rouge. I exercise here in the Baton Rouge. So when
really?
I come to work and then you're a runner, right? I run and I do triathlons.
So where do you run when you get to Baton Rouge?
Well, usually around the lakes. Run around the lakes. I belong to the LSU Rec Center, so I run around the lakes.
So your first stop is at the Rec Center?
Yes.
And then you go to work?
And then I change.
So did you go to the Rec Center this morning?
Yes.
How far did you run today?
I actually swam about a little over a mile and a half, and then I ran about 2.5 miles.
Well, you're obviously in great shape as we talk about health. Perhaps the biggest problem in our state, the fact that we have citizens who are far too large. What are we going to do about that?
And you clearly pointed out an area that the department has been focused on. We will continue to be focused on. One of the ways that we feel like we will make some difference to that is through our Bayou Health Plans, our managed care plans that really allow incentives for people to change behavior. It takes a lot to change behavior, whether that's behavior of people in terms of their eating habits or behavior in terms of going to emergency rooms when they might not need to go to emergency rooms. There are a lot of behavioral changes that have to occur if people want to really change their health, and we want to change health outcomes in Louisiana. Our Bayou Health Plans have the ability and flexibility to offer incentives that Medicaid never could before. You know, they can offer care management that will provide coaches for people to change some of those behaviors, and also incentives when they meet some of their goals. Again, things that we were not able to do previously in traditional Medicaid.
When you say incentives for meeting goals, how does that
work? Well, it depends. Each plan can come up with their own things. I mean, they have the ability, you know, they can give gift cards if people can make some changes. One of the biggest incentives, though, is really having care management, having a coach there, you know, every day, not every day necessarily, but, you know, talking to you frequently about, you know, your goals and what you're doing and managing your diabetes and checking your blood pressure and all those type of things. Those are true incentives for people to change their behavior. If they know somebody's going to call and check up on me and see what's
going on. We truly have an epidemic of type 2 diabetes in this state.
Yes.
And that's largely related to poor diet, lack of exercise, and you're trying to set a good example. So if you start from Thibodaux and go to the rec center and then go to work, so what time do you leave lovely Thibodaux?
I leave Thibodaux typically about 3:45 every morning.
3:45?
Yes.
And then what time do you get home?
Typically between 8 and 9.
And I would imagine you go to sleep pretty quickly.
Otherwise, yes.
You might as well just get a sleeping bag and stay at the office.
But
we're glad you're where you are. Good luck to you. And let's talk again soon.
Right.
Kathy Kleber, Secretary of DHH. And we'll be back in 90 seconds with Terry Burke of the ACLU in Texas. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. We're joined by the Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Texas, Terry Burke. She's held that position for 5.5 years, and she's been a busy person for 5.5 years, but in particular over the last few months. Good morning, Terry Burke.
Good morning. Thank you for having me this morning.
Well, what's going on in Texas regarding abortion legislation?
Well, you know, it's all over but the shouting. We had a regular session of the legislature and two special sessions to get passed. The legislature wanted so desperately to pass a bill, what's now an omnibus bill. It has four really odious elements to it. And it has now passed. The governor has now signed it into law. And three of the four parts of it take effect in mid-October. The fourth takes effect in September of 2014. But the bill itself is reflective of what has been going on across the country. our opponents have a nationwide strategy.
this year through June 30, states have enacted 43 restrictions on abortion. It's the second highest number of any single year. And we've got, you know, six more months to go and a lot of legislatures still meeting. So it is an attempt, it's a backdoor attempt to undo Roe v. Wade.
Well, Texas, my understanding, Terry, now has 42 abortion clinics. It's the second largest state in the country. How many people in Texas now? Well over 20 million people.
It's, I think they say about 26 million.
26 million people. So if this legislation takes hold as the framers hope it will, it will cut the number of abortion clinics significantly, perhaps to as few as five. So you would have five clinics handling 26 million people, so that would be one clinic for about every 5.2 million people. Louisiana has 4.5 million people, and we have a handful of clinics in our state. But we have, as Melinda DeLotte of the Associated Press reported this weekend, many of the same restrictions already on the books in Louisiana that you have in Texas. So this is a trend that is not only evident in your state, it's evident in many places, including this state.
Right. Well, we, like I say, we've seen this going on. It really is. It's a move by extremists. This is not representative of what mainstream Americans or Texans or probably Louisianans want to see. We, for example, have had a number of polls in Texas over the last 6 months. One statewide poll that was done in mid-June that shows that 80% of registered voters in Texas said they didn't want the legislature to take up an abortion bill. 70-something percent said the legislature's business is budget and education and jobs and infrastructure. The legislature does not belong in the role of help of making such private and personal decisions for women. So we know that this is not what, and that poll, by the way, tracks with the national Gallup polls mm-hmm. and others. So it's not, those poll results are not slanted. They're not unique. They are representative of what Americans think on this issue. It's a complicated, you know, I don't think anybody thinks it's an easy issue. It's very complicated and very difficult. But it's so complicated, so difficult, so personal, it doesn't belong in the government's hands.
877-217-5757, wherever you are, for Terry Burke, who is the executive director of the ACLU of Texas, and she led the ACLU Texas work with coalition partners to block a package of anti-abortion rights bills from receiving a vote. What exactly does the bill signed by Governor Rick Perry do?
Well, as I say, there's four parts. One is a ban on abortions after 20 weeks, and that ban has, we've seen it or something similar to it in I don't know how many states in recent years, but that's one element. Second part is requires any physician who does abortions to have admitting privileges in a hospital within 30 miles of the clinic. Third one says that if you are having a medication abortion, which is one done typically up to about 9 or 10 weeks where you take a pill, that you must visit a clinic minimum of three times, if not four times, just to be administered a pill. And then the last part, the one that doesn't take effect till 2014, requires that all abortions be performed in ambulatory surgical centers. These are the centers we often call day surgery clinics. It's where you go to get your gallbladder taken out or your ACL repaired. And so that's why when you mentioned that we have 42 clinics and going down to probably 36 or 37, that's why. If these clinics, if the 42 clinics or 37 that do not currently that are not currently ambulatory surgical centers. For those 37 clinics to become ASCs is extremely costly, and probably just won't happen.
All right, so you're talking about potentially going from 42 to 5. Yes. What does that mean as far as availability? Do people go out of state? Do they just not have abortions? What happens?
Right. Well, Louisiana being our neighbor, I know that you know that Texas is an incredibly large state. And so the effect is that those five or six remaining ambulatory surgical center clinics are all along I-35 or east of I-35. In other words, they stretch from Dallas to San Antonio, and then there's nothing west of there. That's 35% of the Texas population, and that is also the most rural part of our state. So for a woman to seek abortion care who lives out there, she's going to have to take off work, she's going to have to own a car, she's going to have to afford gasoline, and she's going to have to make two, three, or four trips to one of these clinics. So what's going to happen is folks are going to go to Mexico, where abortion is illegal but available, and we'll have a return to the back alley abortions of my college years, and which are people do get harmed by those types of abortions. You're going to see people buying the medication abortion pill online. You can Google it and find it, and you can buy it right now, and that's not safe. Because particularly people may buy it whose pregnancies are too far along or who don't know how to administer it, that sort of thing. People with money will always be able to get an abortion, legal or otherwise. And they will fly out of state, they will whatever. But the people who live in rural Texas who are poor are going to have no access to abortions except the illegal kind.
Do you think Governor Perry acted with nobility, or was he less than noble in his actions during the recently completed legislative squabbles?
Well, I think that Governor Perry and Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst, who really was pushing this, I think when everything shakes out, you're going to see as clearly as I think I do that this is all about primary party politics. Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst lost a Senate race last year because, many say, he was not right-wing enough. He was not extremist enough. And he's very afraid of not being perceived as extremist enough. And he's got a re-election coming up as Lieutenant Governor in 2014. We don't know what Rick Perry's political ambitions are at this point. I guess we know what his ambitions are. We don't know what his plans are. And I suspect his motivations are primary party politics as well, along with many others in the leadership of the state legislature.
Now, in Louisiana, we have veered to the point where we're a solidly red state, some would say flaming red, and that's unlikely to change for a while. But in Texas, the demographics of your state are changing to the point where, in our lifetime, Texas could end up being like California, which used to be a Republican state and is now one of the most reliably Democratic states. Do you sense that at some point Texas will start electing Democrats again to the U.S. Senate, governor, more Democrats in Congress? Is that time coming in the next 10 to 20 years?
Well, I've always believed that pendulum swing. And so I would think that the pendulum will swing in Texas eventually. I am frankly less concerned with whether we elect Democrats or Republicans and more concerned that we just not elect these extremists. The Republican Party, in the legislature of Texas has many, many folks who I would describe as centrist or center-right. As long as we've got folks in the center, we probably are in pretty good shape. But it's when these extremists take hold and lead the po- political landscape, lead the lawmaking, that I think we get in trouble. As far as Texas actually really tilting to a Democratic majority, most of the folks I talked to said we're looking at 2025 or 2030 before that's really going to happen.
Well, that's only 12 to 17 years away.
That's true.
That's not
But you know, there was a Democratic senator who voted for this bill, and there were five Democratic state representatives who voted for this bill. So Democrats are not a guarantee that we won't see this sort of stuff.
There's no doubt. No doubt that, for example, Democrats in Louisiana used to vote heavily conservatively on some issues, including abortion. But the times are changing such that the landscape may be different in Texas in the near future. Now, you worked as a journalist for most of your career.
That's correct.
Part of staffs that won two Pulitzer Prizes. Now, How have the media covered this? Have the media done a good job?
I think on the topic in general, no. And I'm certainly willing to take a little of the blame. I think that way back in the 80s when objections, when the folks who called themselves pro-life began to rise up and protest in front of Planned Parenthood clinics, the media too often framed it as a pro-anti debate. It was the media that said you're either for it or you're against it. And the media never, at that time, didn't really probe the nuances and the complexities of the issue. It was just, and people write the stories and say, well, we quoted a pro-life guy and we quoted a pro-abortion person. So I think from the beginning there were some problems in the way we framed it, and perhaps even in that framing it led us to this becoming the polarizing issue it's become. Perhaps it would have anyway, but I think the media contributed to that. More recently, with the cutbacks in broadcast and newspapers, you have so many fewer editors that occasionally I do run across stories that are very much like those stories from the 80s. I had a conversation with a reporter during the regular session who had written a story where he quoted, you know, three people who were pro-life, quote-unquote, and three people who were pro-abortion, and thought he had done a balanced job. Rather than getting into each one of these elements of this bill that I was describing and telling us what it really means to people. But, you know, thankfully, there's enough good journalism going on today through nonprofits particularly and through some of our mainstay print and broadcast outlets that I think if folks are willing to listen, they're going to get the full story.
Terry, do you think there are four votes? This is from a listener, Phil. Do you think there are four votes on the U.S. Supreme Court to undo Roe v. Wade, to overturn that decision of 40 years ago?
You know, yes and no. I think there are four votes. I think, of course, it's going to take five to undo it, but I think there are four. I do think we have seen with the Roberts Court a tendency to rule on these complex and controversial issues to rule on them in very narrow ways. So it may be that there would be a narrow ruling that would limit abortion but not overturn Roe v. Wade. That's my best guess about the four. Now, you know, there's always Justice Kennedy, the much talked about Justice Kennedy, and I don't know. I heard a fellow at a hearing at the legislature the other night go on for 15 minutes about how certain he was of Justice Kennedy's position, which I said the fellow ought to be making millions telling people what Justice Kennedy thinks. So I don't think any of us know.
Well, if the court stays intact, as it quite possibly will during the final term of President Obama, then that shapes up 2016 as not only an election for president, but probably an election that will determine the composition of the court, either more conservative or less, in the next 5 to 6 or 8 years.
Sure.
And mm-hmm. and if there are four votes, then there might end up being a fifth vote to overturn
right.
Roe v. Wade. Can you imagine what would happen if that occurred?
No, I really can't. And I mean, I think the folks that I talk to, the folks that I work with, that is a very scary proposition to.
All right. We've got to roll, Terry. I'm sorry, but your delight. I hope we talk again soon. Terry Burke, Executive Director of the ACLU in Texas and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Thanks, Terry.
Well, thanks for having me.
And our pleasure. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.